These bankers and these regulators have gone through a period, 1982 to 2022, the most benign financial climate in human history. The interest rate fell and fell and fell. Declining interest rates are very good for capital consumers, for bank borrowers, and they're very good for banks. The value of bonds goes up as the interest rate falls, and loans are bonds. But that circumstance changed. The interest rate has doubled. The benign economic climate is over. The regulators who were trained in a benign period, and some of the bankers who were trained in benign periods, aren't psychologically attuned to the demands of the next decade.
Here at Liberty and Finance, we're licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. We are standing by the inventory, ready to make sure you get what you need, even into the wee hours of night and on weekends, because preparedness doesn't stop. Call us 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're always delighted to have this returning guest, Rick Rule, the former CEO of Sprott Asset Management, now the CEO of Rule Investment Media, joins us this Monday, March 27th, 2023. Rick, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Dunnigan, always a pleasure. I enjoy these conversations.
If you keep having these remote investing boot camps as frequently as you're now cranking them out, we're going to have to keep having you on more often, although that's not any difficulty on our part, because usually our subscribers are asking, when are you going to have Rick back on? So we're glad to have you. And I just heard you've got an upcoming electric and battery metals remote investing boot camp coming up. So I'm going to be asking you about that in just a few minutes. But first, I just wanted to check in with you. I'm sure you're getting deluged with calls from clients asking your opinion of the direction that things are heading regarding banking, which you also have one foot in that door as well, and the stability of the financial complex in general, including the dollar, not the least. But could we start with your assessment, maybe your elevator speech, about the stability of the U.S. and global banking system?
A big question, but one I look forward to discussing with you. You know, Dunnigan, I've been involved pretty deeply with six banks in the past. And as you say, I'm part of starting another bank now. So banking has been of direct interest to me for four decades. Never mind my life as both a depositor and a borrower, which has been fairly extensive. If people were to review the discussions that you and I have had over the last 3 years, Dunnigan, you would find lots of discussions of the bad habits that led up to the circumstance that we're facing now in commercial banking. You and I have talked in the past about the fact that your government, the U.S. government, believes that a 7% equity slice is sufficient in banking, which is to say they encourage banks to be 90% or rather 93% leveraged. That's what fractional reserves are all about. The equity on the balance sheet, which is to say the shareholders' funds, are met as a sort of a deposit against a mismatch in assets and liabilities. So it's important that depositors and shareholders and borrowers, for that matter, understand the leverage inherent in the system and understand the need for the prudent allocation of capital and the prudent management of banks, which we haven't seen. We too, Dunnigan, specifically noted the duration mismatch, which is to say that banks borrowed from depositors or from overnight sources like other banks funds at low interest rates and put them out at higher interest rates in the longer term. Specifically, many banks like Silicon Valley Bank owned mortgage bank bonds with 4, 5, and 6 year maturities, which were funded by demand deposits, which is to say that there was no match between either the durability or the duration of the assets and liabilities. When the interest rates rose precipitously, This did two ugly things to Silicon Valley Bank, which we also discussed, you and I, in earlier discussions. The first is that it raised the cost of the overnight funding dramatically, lowering the spread, the credit spread enjoyed by Silicon Valley Bank. But much more importantly, it lowered the value of the obligations they had on the asset side. If you own a five-year bond, and your five-year bond is paying you then prevailing market interest rates, and the interest rate doubles, what it means is that another investor can buy a different obligation, providing the same yield at a lower price, and it impacts the carrying value of your obligation. Now, if you're a normal person out there and you paid 100 cents on the dollar for this mortgage bond, you hold the thing to maturity, it doesn't matter that much. But if you're leveraged 9.3 to 1, the diminishment in value over a five-year obligation can and does wipe out your book equity. Another problem that banks have are the cash or cash equivalents on their balance sheet relative to their deposit liabilities. A well-capitalized bank has access to immediate liquidity equal to 20 or 25% of the size of their immediate deposit liabilities. Longer-term CDs are different. But to the extent that a bank has in overnight obligations or now accounts, let's say $100 million in deposits, they need to have $20 or $25 million in immediate liquidity available to meet circumstances like today. A further problem with regards to Silicon Valley Bank, and then I'll stop answering this question ad nauseum, was the odd nature of their deposits. Non-core deposits, which is to say brokered or uninsured, large deposits, accounted for 97% of Silicon Valley Bank's deposit base. At most banks, they're 10 or 15%. And the character of these non-core deposits was problematic, too. They came mostly from the venture capital and technology businesses. Venture capital funds would put money on deposit with Silicon Valley Bank that they had raised for investors before they had deployed it in investments. And the technology companies that they financed would put the money raised from equity in Silicon Valley Bank before they spent the money on maintaining or increasing the size of the company. When the technology ecosystem 2 years ago began to show some signs of funding distress, this source of capital began to dry up. Two things happened. Venture capital funds weren't able to raise more money, and they weren't able to allocate more money to technology startups. So the new deposits slowed up the same time that venture capital companies deployed the capital, reducing deposits, and technology companies spent the money growing their businesses. And so Silicon Valley Bank saw its most important source of deposits shrink at the same time that their need for liquidity grew. If you will, the negative perfect storm that took a superbly performing bank from being the 18th largest chartered bank in the United States to extinction in about 4 short weeks.
The plight of Silicon Valley Bank, people wonder whether it was a one-off, and then they saw a couple other banks get into trouble, maybe four total now within the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Your assessment, and the Wall Street Journal came out with a report saying like 186 other banks were in similar straits to Silicon Valley Bank. Your assessment of whether this is in fact just the first tremor and there are liable to be other dominoes to fall as well, or whether you think this was more of a unique case?
I think in the very near term that there will be a lot of psychological distress and somewhat less financial distress. But right now, throughout the United States, faith in the financial system is very strong. People didn't take their money out of bank deposits. They took their money out of smaller regional banks that didn't have an implicit federal guarantee, and they put them in larger banks, which are insolvent. As long as faith remains in the system probably weathers the storm. If the Fed is adroit in managing both its financials and in terms of managing public opinion, whether or not your listeners should trust their savings to this faith is a very different question. It is worthy to note that the mark-to-market mismatch between assets and liabilities in the public banking system in the United States is substantially larger than the size of the treasuries and the Fed's reserves, which is to say the implicit liability is larger than the pool of capital that stands placed to deal with it. What I suspect that your listeners should do is pay attention to the advice that you and I gave them 3 years ago, which is to say, do a little work. Look at the statement of financial condition with the bank that your money is on deposit with. Concentrate your deposits in $250,000 insured amounts or less, and concentrate them on institutions that are prudently run. There are still banks like First National Bank of Alaska or Farmers and Merchants Bank of Long Beach that have equity at 20% of primary assets rather than 6 or 7. There are lots of solvent banks in the United States. There are lots of banks that make loans against good collateral that get paid back. Unfortunately, there are lots that don't, too. And the idea that the big thinkers, the idea that Pelosi or Biden or Greta Thunberg are going to be reasonable stewards of your capital, are going to supply reasonable due diligence to you as to where to deposit your money or who to borrow from. This is a misnomer. It's all down to you. Remember that the big thinkers didn't save you from Enron. Remember that the big thinkers didn't save you from long-term capital management. Remember that the big thinkers didn't save you from Washington Mutual, and they're not going to save you this time either. You have to do it.
That's where a lot of people get kind of paralyzed, because when they look to like Janet Yellen or you name, fill in the blank name, who's like supposedly the most connected, the most at the head of all this stuff, saying, oh yeah, we think the system is sound, or we think this particular bank is just a one-off or whatever. They think, well, if I can hardly read a banking, you know, balance sheet or whatever, and these people are experts at it and they're telling me everything's fine, what they may not be realizing is there's a big conflict of interest on the part of those who are announcing these official pronouncements of stability of the system.
And then again, frankly, a lack of competence. I remember myself in the early 70s experiencing a bull market, and I, Rick Rule, experienced, I confused a bull market with brains. I had 5 or 6 year good years in the market, and I thought I knew something about investing. I learned later just how smart I was. These bankers and these regulators have gone through a period, 1982 to 2022, the most benign financial climate in human history. The interest rate fell and fell and fell. Declining interest rates are very good for capital consumers, for bank borrowers, and they're very good for banks. The value of bonds goes up as the interest rate falls, and loans are bonds. But that circumstance changed. The interest rate has doubled. The benign economic climate is over. The regulators who were trained in a benign period, and some of the bankers who were trained in benign periods, aren't psychologically attuned to the demands of the next decade. And investors need to recognize this. I myself deal with young regulators at the Office of Office of the Comptroller of Currency, at the Fed, at the FDIC. Very, very, very bright, very, very concerned young people. But they work for institutions where the organizational bias reflects big government and a 40-year benign climate. If the purpose of these regulatory agencies were really to protect depositors. If the employees at this organization, at these organizations, were actually charged. By the way, these employees, the ones I've come in contact with around the organization of Battle Bank, are wonderful people. If their charge became less political and became more geared to consumer protection, our banking system would be in very good shape. Now, it might be very difficult for somebody who couldn't afford a home to get a loan on one. It might be that the banking system ceased to exist to subsidize politically correct activities. But the interests of the depositors would be in much better shape, Dunnigan.
If we could shift the focus now from the banking system itself or individual banks to the currency, you could take that as broadly as you'd like, the U.S. dollar or global fiat currencies. People are also concerned, even if, because you've talked to us for years and years and years about have maintain bullion liquidity, maintain cash liquidity, and then you can do your investing and speculating after that. For people who are trying to maintain cash liquidity but are concerned that the purchasing power of their currency is seeming to accelerate in its decline, you've addressed that to us in general in the past, saying, yep, I'd still have rather suffer a 10% decline than not have the liquidity to take advantage of a situation when it presents itself. Any shift in that emphasis based on the potential for acceleration of devaluation of the currency now?
None whatsoever. You need to maintain liquidity. You need to maintain U.S. dollar liquidity if you live in the United States, but you need to maintain it in short-term durations. Don't be a yield whore. Don't put your money out in 5 or 6 year term for 10 or 15 basis points. Have the maturities either demand maturities. Listen, there's plenty of banks out there that are paying 3.5% on demand deposits, or in very short-term treasuries. Anybody can set up a treasury direct account and lend their money directly to the U.S. government in maturities less than a year. Restrict your maturities, maintain liquidity, and do this in the next 60 or 90 days. If you don't own physical gold or silver, if you don't have an insurance policy, put your insurance policy in place, not with 100% of your portfolio, but with enough money that you sleep nights and stay calm. My nervousness isn't about the solvency of the banking system. My nervousness is about the response of the Fed to problems in the banking system. My suspicion is, as the strains in credit markets increase, as liquidity decreases, the policy response from the government will be to increase quantitative easing. Dunnigan, as you and I know, quantitative easing is government speak for counterfeiting. You'll notice that they provided $200 billion in backstop for the banking system without going to the credit markets to borrow it or without increasing taxes. That meant that they counterfeited it. Creating new specious currency units does not increase the value of existing currency units. It decreases them. And my suspicion is that if the current difficulties that we see in credit markets, including the current illiquidity, continues, that the Fed will do whatever it can to lower interest rates. If the market sees a continued conjunction of lower nominal interest rates, lower real interest rates, and increasing counterfeiting, that circumstance is tailor-made for the precious metals market. If you look right now at the arithmetic around the competition for gold and silver, which is the U.S. 10-year Treasury, the U.S. 10-year Treasury pays you a little bit less than 4% in a currency that the government acknowledges is losing 7% of its purchasing power compounded, which means if you lend the government money for 10 years, they solemnly promise to pay you. Let me put it differently. They solidly promise to reduce your spending power by 3% a year compounded for 10 years. That's what gold is competing with. If the real yield continues to decline, that is to say, if there is declining nominal interest rates in the face of continued inflation, and by the way, quantitative easing causes continued inflation, I think you're going to see massive disintermediation from all kinds of long bonds. And disintermediation is a fancy way of selling, say of selling, and a redeployment to other assets, including very short-term denominations and gold and silver. The bottom line of the diatribe that you just heard is, to the extent that you haven't invested in gold or silver, and you're underinvested in gold and silver, this is a wonderful time to increase your allocation, not at the expense of your other liquidity, but particularly at the expense of bond holdings that you may have or savings products that have durations longer than 2 years.
So we've been focusing just now on the monetary metals, gold and silver, which some people consider to be commodities, especially silver. The commodity picture in general is a whole different chapter from everything we've been talking about in this financial world. Is one thing, but it seems that most of the world, as Andy Shechtman mentioned at your last conference in Boca Raton last July, this East-West split, it seems like the BRICS Plus nation, which is now, you can't even call it East-West split if Mexico and Japan are knocking on their door. But anyway, the rest of the world is going away from this purely paper-based or digital-based financial system and going to real things is focusing on commodities. You focused on commodities because you've been focusing on natural resource investing your whole career. So can you bring us up to date on where you see the role of are we heading into this super cycle where commodities are going to be king for the foreseeable future in the face of this crumbling Western edifice of the financial world?
I think we will head into a super cycle, although I'm not convinced that we'll head into it in the next 2 or 3 years. The thing that derails a supercycle is, of course, a recession, and we need an economic slowdown. I think in an economic slowdown, what you'll find is that commodities are already cheap. So they don't get proportionately more cheap compared to assets that aren't cheap now. But if you look beyond the next recession, we have underinvested in natural resources for 30 years. We are going to have supply shortages, and we're going to have supply shortages throughout the natural resources space.
Clarification, please. You just said we've underinvested in natural resources. I think, did you mean in exploration and development of sources?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We said this before, Dunnigan, in the copper business as an example. I'm an icon for copper mines. I'm old. I'm past my prime. Most of the copper mines that we're living on worldwide were discovered 60 and 70 years ago. Bingham Canyon's 155 years old. Chuquicamata is 115 years old. Grasberg, 60 years old. These mines are past their prime. They're long of tooth. Meanwhile, demand for copper is exploding. We're going to have to pay the piper in higher copper prices, in higher cobalt prices, in higher zinc prices, in higher oil and gas prices, all of these things. You can have declining supply if you have a recession or a depression and declining demand. But I'm a real bullish person in terms of the ultimate future of humankind. We've done a wonderful job as a species over the last 40 years, lifting the poorest of the poor out of dire poverty. And hopefully we continue to do that. Poor people want to live like you and I want to live better. And all of that, the raising of material living standards of 8 billion of us on Earth, require more resources. This requirement for more resources is going to run head on into declining sustaining capital investments in resource industries and 30 years of underinvestment in resource industries. This is a wonderful circumstance for myself and other resource investors, and a somewhat more challenging climate for consumers, people who want to increase their material standards of living.
When you talk about to really get a super cycle in commodities, you need a post-recession recovery period to really do that. Even in a recession, there are certain government policies of the day, you mentioned Greta, et cetera, that can drive spending even when it's not being driven by the actual organic culture itself. So one thing that's this whole green energy movement, et cetera, renewables. So your upcoming boot camp on electric and battery metals investing, I think must be focused partly on the fact that you're anticipating sort of government policies that are gonna drive disproportionate demand in those areas.
Not just government policies, but yes, government policies. for the first time in my life, Donegan, I seem to be politically correct. The big thinkers want more electricity. That means they got to come through investors like me to get it. And I almost don't care about how they pay me, as long as they pay me. I make fun of alternative energy, but I've been funding alternative energy projects for 30 years. I don't care how you pay me for energy, as long as you pay me. The electrification of developed nations is a really good thing. And the increasing availability of electrification for the poorest of the poor is a good thing, too. So I guess to the extent that the government decides to subsidize me, I'm prepared to take it. But I think that your listeners need to understand that it isn't just government policy. A billion people worldwide have no access to electricity, Donegan. None. 2 billion people worldwide have access to intermittent or unaffordable electricity. We've done a great job in the last 40 years extending electrification to 2 billion people who didn't enjoy it before. And we need to continue that. And as we continue to do that, we need to increase the energy density in all kinds of people's life. This doesn't just mean generative electricity. It doesn't just mean uranium and oil and gas. It means copper to get it to them. It means distributed storage, a fancy way for saying batteries. This whole panoply of economic activity around energy density and material well-being plays right into these energy and electricity metals. Now, it's important to note, Donegan, that I didn't choose this topic for the boot camp. My listeners, my subscribers, the people who attend the boot camp get polled as to what subject they'd like us to have next. The first boot camp we have, as you'll recall, was the uranium boot camp, because more people that were users of Rural Investment Media wanted to hear about uranium than anything else. After that, we asked them all what you want to hear about next. They said silver. After that, we asked them what they wanted to hear about next, and they said battery and electric metals. Now, I happen to think they made the right choice, because I think this is a fascinating topic. And it's a topic that's changing very, very, very rapidly. And it's also a topic that conventional resource investors have understood less well than they should. So in this case, I think the market made the right choice. But it was a market-determined curriculum.
Okay, so in response to that need for an interest in investment advice or perspectives around battery and electric metals, you have organized this 100% virtual boot camp that's coming up. We've had two of them before. You mentioned uranium and silver. We'll put a registration link in the description of this video with the details on the dates and so on. But what can people look forward to at this virtual boot camp?
Well, I think it's going to be spectacular. People who attended the uranium boot camp will remember that at the beginning of that boot camp, WMC Metals put on an overview of uranium that I think was worth the price of admission to the uranium boot camp. The WMC Metals people have a 30-year track record in electric and battery metals, and so they will begin the boot camp by doing an overview of the technology and the applications and the supply and demand scenarios around a variety of metals, including, of course, copper and cobalt, but extending all the way down into things like vanadium and lithium and rare earths. That will be followed, of course, by special presenters with a special knowledge, analysts and portfolio managers and commentators. In addition to that, like with every other conference, either virtual or in-face that we have, we will have sponsors, in this case, public companies or purveyors of services in electric and battery metals. And it's important to note, Donegan, that every public company sponsor that we have are public companies that we own, which is to say, there's no guarantee because we own them that the share price will go up, but there is a guarantee that we understand them well enough that we've invested our own time and treasure in them. And importantly, Donegan, any investor who pays for and attends this boot camp will have access to the archives for 6 months. So you don't need To remember everything that you saw. In fact, you don't need to attend it in person, although we would encourage it. You have access to the information to refresh your memory time and time again. And if you think that you didn't get your tuition's worth, send me an email. This comes with a 100% money-back guarantee. I can't give you the 8 hours back that you spend at the boot camp, but if you don't think that over eight hours I didn't give you $99 worth, I'll give you the $99 back.
And this is very easy to take advantage of because you can watch from the comfort of your own home and on your own schedule, as I understand, since it's 100% virtual. And when you said if you can't attend in person, I assume you meant not live while it's being simulcast, but if you pick it up later on the recordings. How long will there be access to the recordings for those who pay to attend the conference?
They will be up for those who paid to attend the conference for 6 months.
Okay. And in the past, you've also offered additional services and information to our viewers if they were to email you, or not email you, to go to a landing page that you provide. Is that still available?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I love talking to your subscribers, your listeners, about natural resource investing, and I have an incentive for them. Any of them who care what I have to say about resources, in particular their specific resources, are invited to find out by going to ruralinvestmentmedia.com. When you go there, list your natural resource portfolio. Please no tech stocks. Please no pot stocks. Please no crypto. Confine me to what I know. I'll rank the stocks in your portfolio individually, 1 to 10, if I know them. I will also comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have some value. While you're there, if you're concerned about your bank and want to be involved in a better bank, if you want to be paid interest on your checking account, if you want to establish an IRA that can own duplexes or fourplexes that you operate, if you want to borrow money against your precious metals holdings, or simply if you care about being part of a better bank, in the question and comments section, list bank. Finally, if you're an accredited investor interested in doing private equity placements or private debt placements, for that matter, and you care about what private placements I'm participating in, I'm prepared to tell you for free. If you're an accredited investor interested in private placements, in the question and comment section, simply write down placements, and I will include you on the notification list at no charge, where I will disclose to you those private placements which are available to other investors. Note, I charge you no fee for this, and I don't charge the companies any fee for it either. It's totally free.
Well, I understand that hundreds and hundreds of our viewers have taken advantage of those offers over the last years, and it's still available now. That's awesome. They'll find all the descriptions in the link in the description of this video. So, and folks, also remember, if you don't want to miss a single interview with Rick or any of our returning guests, make sure you go to libertyandfinance.com, all spelled out, libertyandfinance.com. Put in your name, your email address, click submit, and you'll get one confirming email. Once you confirm, you'll be in. You'll get one email in your inbox every day with our latest interview and any specials. And Rick, we're always glad to have you here giving us your perspective of your decades of experience in the natural resource space. It certainly seems to be an area that is going to deserve our close attention this year and in years to come. And we're glad to have you always with us here on Liberty and Finance.
Well, Dunnigan, thank you for the wonderful conversations that we've had over the years. And thank you, too, for your continued support of our educational products, like our conferences and our boot camps.
Thanks, Rick. Glad to have you back. Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you, sir.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH, or electronic check. money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.